Welcome to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. In this show, our hosts explore success and advancement through education by interviewing today's top leaders in the fields of education, business, and technology in order to provide insight into what it really takes to succeed. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com. All right, let's get into the show.
You're tuned to Education and Empowerment Podcast. This is your host, Bakhtir Soyev. And this morning, I'm coming to you with an excellent episode of an interview with Michael Aiken. Michael Aiken is a community builder and a change maker who has consistently and successfully tackled challenges by committing to the idea of doing good and doing well are not mutually exclusive. He has done so while building authentic relationships and connections locally and around the world that help people, organizations, and institutions thrive. Michael and his team have created an entire industry based around authentic hyper-local engagement and proven the market viability of a firm that does only community-serving work, generating meaningful social impact in a way that is profitable and sustainable. Please help me welcome Michael. Michael is the president and CEO of Link Strategic Partners, a strategic communication stakeholder engagement and social impact consulting firm proudly based in Washington, D.C. In 9 years, Link has expanded from a small local shop to a national firm with hundreds of local, regional, national, and international clients. Link's mission-driven work includes thousands of pro bono work provided to community partners. In this episode, Michael Aiken and I will be discussing leveraging strategic partnerships in education to succeed in the post-COVID world. For our listeners who are involved or interested in the importance of strategic partnerships, whether you are a CEO, president, or leader of higher education institution, buckle up. Because in this episode, we're going to talk about the importance of strategic partnerships and more. You'll also learn about the challenges in higher education and how to solve those challenges through strategic partnerships. Because Link Strategic Partners has the experience and expertise you need. We will also make the case for why institutions need to outsource or partner on certain aspects. What are the key elements of strategic partnerships and why are they so important? All right, I can't wait to get started. Hello and welcome to Education and Empowerment Podcast. In this episode, I will be speaking with Michael Aiken. And our topic today is leveraging strategic partnerships in education to succeed in post-COVID world. It is going to be a very interesting episode, so buckle up. And we're going to learn a lot about strategic partnerships and higher education. So without further ado, I want to turn to Michael Aiken. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's great. We appreciate your time and we are so excited to learn about you and what you do in higher education. So just to get us started, can you tell us a bit more about how'd you get into the field?
Absolutely. So I run a social impact firm. We're called Link Strategic Partners. We're a consulting firm that helps people communicate effectively, but also engage their communities and stakeholders in really authentic ways. And my background in this work comes directly out of my higher education work. I attended George Washington University, and while I was there, I started working as a student. Following my year as a community organizer, I started working as an intern in the Office of Government and Community Affairs. And at the time, there wasn't an Office of Government and Community Affairs. It was an Office of Government Affairs. And when I got there, I realized, wait, there's some community issues that we should be looking at, and kind of fell into that work as a student intern in the office. Fast forward to a decade later, when I was leaving the university as Assistant Vice President of Government, International, and Community Affairs, we'd built out an entire community affairs function that really leaned in and embraced our role as a higher education institution that needed to also be a very active community partner. I think my interest in higher ed comes from being a student, being a staff member, being an alumni, and now leading a firm that does a lot of work in the town gown space, both with higher education and also with community partners and cities, et cetera.
That's amazing. That's fantastic to hear. And we certainly look forward to exploring more about what Link Strategic Partners does. But before we get into that, I was curious, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about what were your strategic observations of what higher education was facing? Let's suppose COVID didn't happen, where it was going, and obviously now that the pandemic happened, what are your observations where it's going now?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think the last year or so has reoriented everyone's thinking and everything, and in sometimes very scary ways, but hopefully in some ways that help us realize that this is an opportunity to build back to not just to normal, but to something that is a better, more equitable version of normal, because normal was leaving a lot of people out. I think higher ed is kind of in the core of that. I think the higher education industry or sector was going through changes and is continuing to go through changes. But I think a lot of it comes down to who is higher education for? And this idea that it's for some people and not for others looks at this relationship from top to bottom. Look at it in the context of a university or college's relationship with its surrounding neighbors. If it's a collection of students who the only relationship they have with their surrounding community is because they walk through it on their way to and from their student housing or to and from their way to campus, that's a very different relationship than if those institutions embrace their role as being a full community partner. And I think we're seeing that, especially after this last year, we have to take a full reevaluation of the role that higher education plays and the role that cities and communities play, whether you're affiliated with the university or not. And not to go all the way back, but if you think of this whole idea of town-gown tensions, universities, when they started, were walled, right? There were big walls around. Right. Go back to the historic model in Oxford. Why were there walls around campuses? At the time, it was to kind of keep the pressures of the external world out,
right?
Dollars to focus on scholarship. Somewhat noble idea, right? We'll block everything out, we'll focus on scholarship. What they became, unfortunately, over many, 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 many decades and centuries, is walls that physically and literally separated campuses from the communities they were a part of. And you had these often very elite institutions that were in parts of communities that didn't reflect at all the demographics of the community on campus or the demographics of the campus in the community. And so the walls became the place to keep them out and us in. And that set up a lot of tensions that took a lot of time to build back from, right? This idea that we need to physically and literally take down the walls, find ways for communities and campuses to work together because these can and need to be mutually beneficial partnerships, I think has come into absolute clarity, especially over the last year.
That's amazing. And a follow-up question to that. I mean, back then it was a wall, but what would you say that wall is now?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think in many cases, it's still physical. We do a lot of work in campus planning and literally taking the walls down, finding ways for the surrounding community to benefit from the campus, et cetera. There's still an element of that. I think some of it is financial, right? Who has the access to these institutions? And I think some of it is this idea that there's still an us or a them, that this is for these people, this is for these people. We have to break that down and look at the role of higher education, not in a traditional sense. If you look at the percentage of college students who are also raising children while they're in college, it's extraordinarily high. This idea that it's, right, 4 years, you get out of college, you get out of high school, you go spend 2 or 4 years at a college. That is not the experience of the majority of people going to college right now, but the majority of the college experience is still set up with that in mind. And so we've got to completely change that if we really want to lean into the.
As we're speaking, what you said did remind me of two very critical aha moments that I had. And one was in my graduate school where we were exploring the whole idea of stakeholders and stakeholder now in higher education, as well as the role of education and whether it should be run by private or government or by public institutions or nonprofit institutions, where I sort of stumbled on the idea of social impact and social impact investments and social entrepreneurship and how that helps really uncover a lot of potential. And those are the two critical things that I really admire in what you do. And I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about what Link Strategic Partners does and how you guys came into place and what some of the problems are you solving and how you're helping institutions.
I love talking about this. Absolutely. And let me give you one statistic on the point I just made, the student-parent piece. 1 in 5 college students is parenting while they're a college student. 1 in 5, right? This is a big population, so there's a lot there. So Link came about. I started Link 9 years ago, and we didn't see a lot of firms, professional services firms, in this space of authentic engagement, right? There are marketing communications firms, there are lobbying firms, and they all have their role. We're neither one of those. We're a firm that really looks at what is the most authentic and effective way to communicate and to engage stakeholders and community members in decision-making. So we call ourselves a social impact consulting firm. That's a very broad definition, but we really find that our work doesn't fit neatly in any one sector. We do public, private, nonprofit. We work with two-person nonprofits and tens of thousands of people, corporate partners, and everything in between. The work is really, how are you authentically meeting people where they are, listening to what their needs are, and then putting together a process to move the entire project forward? Sometimes that means we're working with institutions of higher education and helping them rethink their community engagement philosophy. What's it mean to be a good off-campus partner? But then broader than that, what does it mean to be a role, an institution of higher education in meeting the needs of our cities, of our regions, of our countries, and globally? So often we're a thought partner in that. We do a lot of work at the state and municipal level. So if you think of like town gown, you've got the gown side, the universities, you've got the town side. What do mayors and city managers and city councils and police chiefs, et cetera, economic development officials need to do their jobs really effectively? How are they engaging with their stakeholders in the most effective way? We do a lot, not just in higher education, but in K-12 education and early childhood education. And we do a lot of work on the corporate side where you have large corporate partners thinking about what is our responsibility beyond the bottom line, right? What is our corporate social responsibility to be better and more effective partners going forward? And so we put together a company that does all of that. So marketing and communications and online and digital engagement and everything in between. And it's been a really nice way to do work that matters while also building a really sustainable business model in the process.
That's amazing. And that's very, really empowering. A lot of the conversations I had with experienced higher education experts and presidents and association presidents and chairmen is around the idea that in the past, we were looking at education and higher education as a sort of competition. Who has a bigger dorm, who has a bigger stadium or physical sports activities and all of that. Whereas the whole notion of competition is changing into the new word collaboration and partnerships. And I was hoping that you could elaborate a bit more about what your observations are. Like, why do institutions need to embrace partnerships?
Partnerships are key to getting anything done, not just in higher education, but not to make this overly philosophical, but if the last year has taught us anything, it's that you can't neatly separate things in any sort of bucket. We are deeply connected. We're connected at a neighbor level. We're connected at a local level. We're connected at a national level. And we're connected globally. It's unfortunate that it takes a global pandemic to bring that into focus, but we have to find ways to partner, right? No institution, no organization, and no individual is going to be effective all on their own in the way that they would if they work together. So you talked about kind of collaboration being key. We've really seen the power of convening being a very key role that higher education specifically has been able to play through this last year.
Right. Now,
universities always hosted symposiums and they brought people together and all that. But that's different than we're going through something that's both local and global. Who has the power of convening resources, right, in those moments? And so you saw, I saw a lot of higher education institutions say, okay, we need to pull together our public health experts that work in our school with the local city officials and the public health department and our off-campus partners and our grocery stores and our restaurants. And we need to convene discussions about how we're going to survive this year and what are the policies around that. That's really powerful. And some of these convenings happened way before it, but not in the same intensity that I saw now. I'll give you a really specific example. We do a lot of work with a group called the International Town Gown Association. I'm one of their new board members, but we've worked with them for a long, long time. There's another organization in the UK called the UK Town Gown Association, which we do a lot of work with. Link has an office in Manchester, England now, and we're doing a lot of this type of work. We were part of a convening with a number of UK-based institutions, and something really stood out. There was this idea that at the beginning of the pandemic, when everything was locking down, you still had a lot of universities that had huge student populations that were on campus, right? So we're no longer holding courses, but we also can't put people on planes, trains, and buses to send them home. So you have this whole population of students that need services, though the universities are closed, and they need to access resources like food and groceries.
Right.
And the community is understandably concerned about what it means for all these people to have these needs. So there's this really interesting discussion about, well, we as universities have the wherewithal to basically build grocery stores in our student dorms. We could take our student union, we could build our own grocery store and provisioning system, and we could make sure our students have groceries, which is probably the right call early in a pandemic. But you also have all of the neighborhood stores and restaurants that are suffering at the same time. So if the university is forming their own economy out of necessity, but they don't think about what that does to the surrounding community, you've solved one problem, but you've made everything in the surrounding community worse. So instead of doing that yourself, why don't you reach out to the local grocer or the local store and say, we want to build a grocery store on campus for our students, but we want to do it with you as a partner. We're not taking this away. We're just doing it in a way that's safer and meets people where they are. I think that level of convening, sometimes it takes necessity to find those partnerships, but it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense if you do it the right way.
That's amazing. And that's really a good example. I have seen partnerships both to B2G level, B2B level, B2C level. And what I do in my role as the head of strategic partnerships at Forestay, I build partnerships. So it's really amazing to see the examples that you bring, as well as what I learn a lot from working with colleges, universities in the States and Canada, is that they starting to embrace this whole idea of outsourcing. And we're seeing so many institutions actually embrace a technology mindset and embrace a partnership mindset. We provide cloud-based technology solutions for colleges, universities. And the example that you brought is the exact same reason why many institutions are embracing technology and Forestay and other solutions in place. I was curious that maybe you can walk us through, maybe for our listeners out there who are university people, VP of enrollment, or anyone who is in the role of building partnership. Where do you start? What's the first step? What would be the critical components or elements of a strategic partnerships? And why would you call it strategic? What will make it strategic, I guess, is the question we want to explore too.
No, that's a great question. And I can give you a couple of examples around this as well. So to me, partnerships work best when all the partners are clear on why they're being asked to be part of the partnership. That doesn't mean that everyone has to benefit out of every partnership, but if both parties aren't benefiting, it's not a partnership. And that's okay too. It's okay for a university to reach out or a neighborhood to reach out and say, we need this, can you provide it? That's great. And the answer should probably be yes, but if it's not mutually beneficial, then maybe it's not a partnership. Maybe it's a trade, right? Maybe it's
right. Service
and volunteerism, and that's fine. But partnerships we find to be so much longer lasting because they go beyond the immediate needs of a moment. Often they're forged in the immediate needs of a moment, but if you're doing these the right way, they can really last beyond that. So giving kind of all parties the ability to be really clear and upfront at what they're hoping to get out of this. And the more mutually beneficial a partnership can be, the more long lasting it's going to be over the very, very long run. I think that's a really, really key part of this. I'll give you a couple examples. There's a great little restaurant in Washington, D.C., where I'm based called Tonic. Tonic used to be at an old pharmacy building in the center of George Washington University's campus. It's now a little neighborhood bistro called Tonic. It's been there for, I don't know, 15 years. Great little place. Great tater tots, American comfort food. Their entire business model is students and the surrounding business people and all the neighbors. In the middle of a pandemic, students were gone. Businesses had vacated downtown D.C. Neighbors were doing what they could do, but if you only have a fraction of your population still buying food, that gets really, really tough.
Right.
So you're able to put together this really unique partnership between this little neighborhood restaurant called Tonic and George Washington University Hospital. Not the university, but the hospital, which was operating not only at full capacity, but full capacity and more. What does that partnership look like? So when we got both parties, the CEO of the hospital in the middle of a pandemic and the proprietor of this restaurant together on a call, it was a brief call because everyone was busy, but we said, there's something here. You have a population, you have food, what can we do? And in a matter of moments, it started firing. The hospital CEO said, wow. I have doctors and nurses that are working around the clock. Wouldn't it be great if I could cater the doctor's lounge with something that's not just wrapped up sandwiches? We'll pay you. Could you bring in some food and cater the doctor's lounge? Could we put together food kits where these nurses who aren't seeing their families very often, but they're going home, they could pick up a food kit on their way out of the hospital and they could take it home and it could have freshly prepared food they could make for their families. Our cafeteria workers need a little bit of a break. Could you come in every Thursday and just take over the cafeteria counter? And it became this really great thing where the restaurant was getting some partnership and some revenue. The hospital was getting something new and different to show their staff they were really cared for. that's a really low risk partnership and a super high reward partnership, right? So
that's amazing.
Those are the things I think make a lot of sense. Taking it back to your world specifically in off-campus student accommodations, your buildings and buildings where students live became the center of all activity over the last year, right?
Right.
You are providing everything that people needed in many ways, either in short-term or longer-term ways. There's a responsibility there and a partnership that says, instead of us as a university trying to coordinate with every single place where our students live off campus, I'm going to work with my partners over here that are already doing that for me. A strategic partnership makes both people's lives easier, right? If I call you, I can get to all the students and all your properties more quickly than if I have to work with every individual landlord. So I think those partnerships can be really, really strong. There was another example that I just think is a fun one. This is, again, in Manchester, England. I think it was Manchester. It was in the UK, where there were a lot of foreign students that were kind of stuck, right? They weren't allowed to go back home. Their universities weren't open, but they were there. And in some cases, foreign governments were sending things to their students, right? Here's some masks. Here's some hand sanitizers. We know we can't bring you back, but in the short term, here's a care package. In the UK at the time, and I believe it was Manchester, the Chinese government, it sent a whole bunch of care packages to the Chinese national students that were staying off campus but couldn't get back home. The students then organized themselves and said, there's a massive shortage of all things masks and hand sanitizer off campus. We don't need everything here. Let's pool all of this and create a drive to support the surrounding community, right? That was students taking resources they had and organizing it within where they were living and meeting a community need. So sometimes these partnerships aren't top down. Sometimes they're very grassroots up, and I think that can be a really good example as well.
You brought some very, very good examples, and I really, really appreciate that. And our conversation is very timely, especially with our co-founder's article on Forbes about the tips that he shared for higher education about digital transformation. And one of them is look out for win-win. And I think in all of the examples that you brought, they were definitely, you know, win-win. And the whole idea of crowdfunding and crowdsourcing of specific solutions does really bring a lot of opportunities for partnerships. Michael, what would you say would be the important metrics or key performance indicators for an established partnership? Suppose University X had an issue and they found a partner. What are some of the elements that they need to look out for to see if there's progress in that partnership?
So I have kind of two general rules of thumb when I'm talking to people about these partnerships. Often they're coming together at a moment when things are pretty vague, right?
Right.
No, we need something. We need it quickly. Who's a partner we can work with? But the longer they stay vague, the least successful they're going to be. So I advise people when you're trying to put together a partnership, embrace the uncertainty and the vagueness when you're finding your partner, but then also embrace the need to formalize as much of it as you can as you get your feet under you and you understand it's working or not. That protects all parties in a really positive way. We at Link, every year, about 30 to 40% of all of our work is either pro bono or low bono work. So either free or discounted. How do you run a growing, successful Inc. 5000 growing firm that is also giving away a third of all its work? Well, we embrace this idea of strategic partnerships, right?
Right.
There's a lot of other non-cash ways for partnerships to work. So for us, if we're working with a nonprofit that desperately needs communication services around their issue, but they could never afford a firm like Link, we'll say, okay, great, let's take cash off the table for a second.
Exactly.
What do you have that could be beneficial to us? Okay, you do a gala every year. That gala is filled with all the people we need to know. Why don't we trade $50,000 worth of our communication services for the title sponsorship at your gala? You pay us nothing. It costs you nothing to put us on the signage, but we need three tables. We need to present a couple of awards and we'll be at the front of the room. Suddenly we've taken cash away, but we're getting everything we need out of that in a marketing sense. They're getting everything they need out of a professional services sense. And that works. We did the same thing at the beginning of the pandemic. Beginning of the pandemic, like a lot of folks suddenly didn't see communications and marketing and as their most biggest need, right?
Right?
Understandable. You're trying to keep your people employed. You're going to cut all the things you can cut. So we adopted at the very beginning of the pandemic, this metric of people, clients, communities. We were going to keep our people safe and employed to start with.
When right.
We let our team know that, everyone could take a breath and say, okay, I have a lot to worry about right now, but staying employed is not one of them. On the back end, we had to figure out how to pay for that, but we made that pronouncement up front to keep everyone safe. Then we set our clients. A lot of our clients
don't have revenue right now. We do a lot of work with restaurants, theater companies, arts companies, nonprofits, et cetera. So we just proactively went to our clients and said, we know that we are not a financial priority right now. We also know that this time is better than ever for us to be working together. So for our restaurant partners, we said, can we convert our cash partnership to a barter partnership so that when we get on the other side of this and reopen, you host our holiday parties, you host our business lunches, and we have a trade account. For our theater partners, when we get on the other side of this, can I bring our entire team and their families to a couple opening nights? So we went to a barter and trade partnership that still had value, but kept us in there in that moment. And then we said, communities, what issues do we want to work on that currently we're not? How do we go out there and find those and really do it? That was the right thing to do. It kept our team going forward. But, and here's the important part, it also was a really good business case. We didn't know it at the time, but by keeping our entire team employed, by working in all the industries that were being decimated, and by leaning into all our community partners, we were one of the few people in our sector that were doing those things. So 6 months later, when suddenly there were all these contracts that needed to find firms that could do vaccine messaging and public health messaging and restaurant outreach, we were fully staffed. We had lots of past performance and we were involved in all the issues that we needed. And so we went from the worst two quarters we've ever had to ending the year with a profit and hiring more people because we made those strategic partnership decisions without letting like the really specific cash piece get in the way. So I think it's a good example of kind of being a little bit flexible, but then quickly converting it into something formal as circumstances allow. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. And I think you brought very interesting indicators and metrics to consider. And that's certainly very empowering. So a couple of more questions kind of as we start wrapping up our episode is that looking right now, what would you say are the biggest areas of opportunity for higher education? I know fall is coming. Everyone is excited. There's been injection from the government into higher ed. There are lots of good things are happening. But what would you say if you are addressing this to senior presidents and vice presidents and whoever is in charge of clicking that big button of innovation at higher education institutions? What's your message to them?
Don't be overly eager to go back to the way things were. There were a lot of things that weren't working before. And there were a lot of innovations that came out of this year. Right. There are also a lot of things that happened this year out of necessity that shouldn't be continued because they're leaving a lot of people behind. But innovation to me is about kind of learning from the moment you're in and trying to apply that to the moment that's next. And I think this last year has proven us a lot of what works and what doesn't. I'll give you a really quick non-higher ed example that I think is completely relevant. We've done a lot of work this year with community health centers, just really amazing community health centers across the country. And I was talking to the head of one of the community health centers that said, we have talked for years about what it would take to switch to telehealth, right, as our model.
Right.
We always had some version of the 9 month to 9 year plan for switching to telehealth. Wow. We all had this, right? And then this last year, we converted to telehealth in a long weekend, right? We closed, we opened back up, and everything was virtual. It helped us realize that that was done out of necessity, but maybe some of these timeline horizons, we could do them a lot more if we needed to. So let's lean in what works there. I think the same for higher ed. There are a lot of drawbacks to virtual education. There are also a lot of ways that virtual education can open up accessibility for lots of people. So we've got to find that balance, right? We've got to find that balance of what needs to be in person on campus, what doesn't, and let's stop trying to arbitrarily draw those lines in a way that's not informed by the people we're serving.
That's really good message out there for them. And is there any, the biggest lesson learned out of a pandemic that you want to talk about briefly?
God, there are so many. The biggest lesson learned. So I think the last year has shown us that people live complex and complicated lives.
Right.
In a way that was really hard to turn away from. And I'm not saying most people were trying to turn away before. But suddenly, when you are presented on screen with everything that's happening in your team's lives, in your students' lives, in your family's lives, it's really hard to act like, well, when you come to this classroom and shut the door, everything that happens out there happens out there. I'll say this to bosses and CEOs as well. You can't say any longer that when you come to work, this is work and that's life. Life and work are blending in ways that they've always blended. We just acted like it didn't happen. So I think my biggest lesson that I hope we're all taking out of this year is, people are complicated. Life is complex. We need to leave room for that in all of our institutions, in higher ed, and our employment, in the way that government delivers services. If we can embrace that, kind of understand that we're going to be better off and that our systems are going to adapt to it in ways that treat people as people, not as just kind of numbers in an admissions chart or cogs in a wheel. It's got to be more than that. And if we do that well, I think retention rates will go up, right? If we do that well, graduation rates go up, employment rates go up. So it's not just do it because it's the right thing to do. I think if we do it well and people see that they have their spot in whatever system they're a part of, that's going to lead to much better outcomes that can work for everybody.
We actually at Four Stay faced the same thing for years. We were talking about, well, I think we should take one day out of the week to work from home, and everyone will be like, no, we're going to miss out on this one, on this one. And I think in matter of just, okay, tomorrow we're not coming to the office, to everyone going online and working, and we're still managing this huge international company from our homes. It's amazing to see how the world changed us. And actually, two things that I personally learned is being flexible and reach out for help when needed. And it's very timely, especially with what we're discussing today about finding the people to work. An interesting book that I read was also about who, not how. So it's finding the right who's and filling your life in with the right people that can do the right things. And those are the biggest takeaways for me. That's kind of where we land, I guess.
I like that. Who, not how. That is such a good way to do that. We I know we're wrapping up here, but when I look at like at my team, right? Not to be cliche, but I call them like the Link family. When we look at the Link family, our youngest employee is 16. Our oldest employee is 93. That's a big range, right? We are 65% people who identify as female, and we're about 70% people of color. All of those are in precise definitions, but it gives you a really good sense of we really want our firm as a community-based firm, not just to be espousing community principles, but we need to be in and of the communities that we're serving. And I think that's another thing that hopefully has come out of this last year. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to do it. So if we're moving from kind of the performative engagement to the normative engagement, and this is the way it is, I think that can be a really positive thing for far beyond Link and Four Stay, who are getting so much of this right. I think there's so much out there that we can kind of all learn in together and hopefully move forward.
We look forward to doing that. I'm sure our listeners will find this episode very useful. What would be the best way to find you if they reach out for help?
Absolutely. So if you go to linksp for strategicpartners.com, that's the best way to find our information. You can also follow me on social media at DC Michael A, and all my contact information is on our website. So I look forward to being in touch if I can be helpful in any way.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time on behalf of Education and Empowerment Podcast, as well as Four Stay. I extend our appreciation for such an informative and empowering and highly motivating episode. I'm sure our listeners will find it useful. For the listeners who are curious about what Four Stay does, check us out at fourstay.com or explore our solutions at offcampus.fourstay.com. landlords.fourstay.com, and feel free to subscribe our podcast so you never miss an episode like the one that you just listened today with Michael Akin. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, sir. This was great.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Education and Empowerment Podcast. This show is brought to you by Four Stay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Fourstay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.fourstay.com and landlords.fourstay.com.